And we hear first from Ms. Nestor.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Nestor. I'm an assistant federal public defender here on behalf of James Ford Seal Appellant. Your Honors, I believe there are four undisputed truths in this case that directly are going to relate to your decision on the statute of limitations argument. Number one, when the United States Supreme Court in 1968 in the Jackson case decided that the language in the 1201 statute was unconstitutional on its face and judicially excised it and severed it, that case was correctly decided, but has never been questioned by any court or Congress. The second undisputed truth, when the kidnapping statute was amended in 1972 by Congress, Furman had already come down. Furman had already been an issue questioning the death penalty language and other federal statutes. The only federal statute that Congress specifically amended and removed entirely the death penalty language was 1201. None of the other cases under the Furman holding were addressed in 72, simply the kidnapping case. That's the second undisputed truth. Third undisputed truth is there is not one circuit nor a Supreme Court holding that has held since the Jackson case that 1201 should be treated as a capital case. Not one case.
Has there any that said it should not be?
It has not been addressed, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe that's what I'm hoping you're going to do. The fourth undisputed truth is, and this is in direct response to Your Honor's question that was posed to me via email on Friday, the ex post facto clause does prohibit retroactive application of a new statute of limitations that will revive one that has already expired. That is clear. I don't believe the government is going to dispute that at all. I have provided Your Honors with the Stogner case, which makes very clear that once a statute has expired, and if this court finds that either through Jackson or through the 72 amendment that the statute expired in this case, the 94 amendment absolutely constitutionally cannot revive it. There are cases that allow when a statute of limitations is still running, Congress can pass a law to extend it. But once it's expired, it violates ex post facto. I believe that is an undisputed truth. I think all four of these points are critical in Your Honor's decision about when the statute of limitations, which statute of limitations should apply in this case. As we discussed, the step that Jackson took to sever the language in 1201 was extreme. It is very rare, as Your Honors know, for a court to meddle with, in other words, to completely reword or strike out language wholly within the purview of the Congress. But they did that, and it's never, ever been questioned that that was the correct thing to do in this case. That makes kidnapping very different from the line of cases that the government is trying to get this court to apply that comes after Furman. Furman, as Your Honors know, didn't even deal with a federal statute. Furman dealt, as we all know, with state statutes that involved unconstitutionally applied death penalty statutory schemes. The only reference to federal death penalty was in Justice Blackmun's dissent, where he argued that, well, I guess this decision is also going to affect all of our federal cases. From that point on, the Department of Justice and the government interpreted that case to say that unless you provide juries with some type of format to choose whether or not to apply the death penalty, you can't enforce these death penalty statutes. Furman did not alter a single federal statute. It did not excise any death penalty language from any federal statutes. In fact, it wasn't even dealing with a federal statute. Nor did Congress, in the 20-some years prior to the Death Penalty Act in 1994, take any steps to do what they did to the kidnapping statute and delete the death penalty language that was questioned in Furman. So basically what happened is you have this penumbra of capital cases in 1964. Kidnapping is in it. Jackson goes in, pulls the 1201 statute out, and says this is no longer a death penalty case. Death penalty cannot be applied for reasons wholly separate and distinct from what Furman did. Then Congress went so far as to take the language out of the statute books. Now, our position is at this point, the statute of limitations clearly applies under the non-capital version. When
let me just ask you, I mean, we do have these other circuit cases like Manning.
I'd like to address Manning, if Your Honor would allow me.
I understand it says that you look at the purpose of the amendment in light of the collateral effects you want to give to the taking away the death penalty.
Yes, sir.
Why wouldn't that reasoning apply here?
I'll be happy to address that. Manning goes back and adopts the analysis that began in a case called U.S. versus Watson. Watson came down in 73. It was a Fourth Circuit case. It was not a kidnapping case. It was a murder case. Watson looked at it and said, this was shortly after Furman had come down. The circuits were just like, what do you expect us to do? We can't even figure Furman out. I mean, that's where circuits were at that point. The Fourth Circuit came back in Watson and said, in a very literal sense, the murder statute was still a capital crime because the language still existed. Congress had indicated no intent to change it. And based on that, they were continuing to apply all the procedures that were in place for death penalty cases, even though Furman, even though Congress had not repealed it, Furman had not repealed it. The Fourth Circuit said, look, as far as we see, there's been no, we're not going to be the first circuit to say Furman has eliminated all federal procedural rules relating to the death penalty. But the key in Watson was the fact that Congress had indicated no intent to change those statutes or that language and to continue to treat it as capital. And as a matter of fact, there is language in Watson where they specifically distinguished Section 1201 as being different because Jackson had revised it. This Watson case then becomes the building block for all these cases that talk about bail, including and up to Manning. As late as 1995, Manning cites Watson, relies on its analysis, and again is looking at the fact in Manning where a court had come forward and said some death penalty language was unconstitutional, but no Congress, no legislature had come forward and removed it. So they left it in that same penumbra, that same analysis as the Furman cases, where the language is present, we know we're not enforcing it, but we're all still treating it as capital because there's no indication Congress indicated otherwise or intended otherwise.
Yeah, but part of the analysis is that you look at whether the rule, particular ancillary rule that you're dealing with, derives from the nature of the offense or from the application of the death sentence. I mean, if you look at kidnapping as continuing to be an extremely serious crime, then you would, under that reasoning, you could still apply the unlimited statute.
If I could address that with two answers, Your Honor. First of all, you don't even apply that test unless you decide it is one of those crimes that Congress intended to treat as capital, and they looked at congressional intent. So that immediately dictates that under our case, you don't even apply the test. My position is even if you apply the test, even if for some reason you all determine that even though Congress specifically made it non-capital, that for some reason they still meant to apply a capital statute of limitations, apply capital procedures, then my position is the statute of limitation is tied directly to the nature of the penalty, because the statute of limitations on its face says for cases in which you are facing the death penalty. My position is that I think it's distinctly arguable that Manning has been somewhat overruled by the Stogner case. When Stogner came down and said statute of limitations that apply backwards violate ex post facto, what Stogner's doing is it's tying penalties to the statute of limitations, because otherwise it doesn't violate ex post facto. It has to increase the penalty to implicate ex post facto. The Stogner case came down 8 years after Manning. I would submit that I question whether Manning is still appropriate looking at statute of limitations as the nature of the offense versus as connected to the penalty. So first, I don't think you ever even apply that test, because clearly Congress made it known this is not one of those crimes that we feel that way about, because we've altered it and taken out the language. But even if Your Honors believe you do apply the test, I think under the test and under Stogner, statute of limitations is connected to the penalty. So under that test, then, you still should apply the statute of limitations that goes with the 5 years. There is an issue that Your Honors are going to have to decide, and that is, what effect does the amendment in 72 have? Does it go back and capture cases that occurred, offenses that occurred prior to that amendment? There is no clear answer on that. The Provenzano case, which is a Southern District, New York, of course not binding on this court, but certainly the court consider it, had that exact on-point situation. The court in Provenzano had kidnappings under 1201 that occurred before Jackson, before the amendment. The indictment process occurred after the amendment. Provenzano did an excellent analysis of why the savings clause did not apply and why that amendment should be applied retroactively to the statute of limitations, and came to the exact correct conclusion that the government could not prosecute under that situation. It's the only case that is on point with our case. And again, it's not binding, but it is something the court can consider. The Provenzano case does an excellent case of explaining why the government's argument in their brief regarding the savings clause is not appropriate in this case. The savings clause only applies when a statute is being repealed. No one has ever attempted to repeal the statute of limitations. They're trying to piggyback a statute of limitations consideration through a savings clause, and Provenzano has an excellent analysis as to why that's absolutely inappropriate under these circumstances. The other consideration in terms of the statute of limitations is to keep in mind that this court, the Fifth Circuit, was the first one to look at this after Jackson, before the amendment even happened. The Hoyt case, United States versus Hoyt, which came down in 71, before the amendment that Congress did, this court looked at a post-Jackson trial on an offense that had occurred prior to Jackson. And this court stated, clear as a bell, that the district court had no choice in a case where the offense occurred before, but the trial is occurring afterward, that the district court had no choice but to treat the case as non-capital for all purposes, period. There was no qualification to that. There was no loophole to that. The government has tried to create their own argument about what for all purposes means, but it's drawn out of whole cloth. There's nothing in the case other than for all purposes.
Of course, the facts involve how many peremptory challenges a defendant got, wasn't it?
That's correct. It was. It was a procedural issue. And they ruled, and that's correct, it was a procedural issue. Again, we're looking at a situation such as the Daubert case. The government has cited the Daubert case to argue that basically, even though we all agree that the law was unconstitutional in 64, that Daubert puts you on notice. Well, in Daubert, what they fail to say is that a better law, a more ameliorative law, took effect, and that's the law the court applied at the time of trial. We have to look at when this prosecution commenced, when it's reasonable for this defendant to believe he's no longer in jeopardy under the law and under the congressional law, and when that begins, and clearly his statute of limitations expired decades before 1994, prohibiting a retroactive application of that statute. I believe my time is almost up. I would refer Your Honors to the concept that if 72 is ameliorative, if it's improving the law and not damaging the defendant, it can be retroactive. Provenzano explains why it should be retroactive. And at some point, the question of fair play comes into act. At what point, when a government tells you, Congress tells you, and the Supreme Court tells you are out of jeopardy, is it not fair to believe that you are out of jeopardy? And I would submit certainly that 3 decades later far exceeds that.
When did this claim prescribe? I mean, when did this prosecution prescribe, in your view?
When could they have commenced it?
What was the last day they could have legitimately filed an indictment?
Best case scenario, 1969, 5 years from the offense. Also, there's an argument that it could have applied, that it should have started 5 years from 72, which would be 77.
Which one do you take? You'll take either position.
Your Honor, both of them are fine with this defendant. I would be happy with either one, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Calderon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Tova Calderon, and I represent the United States in this appeal. Your Honors, we agree with the defense that the issue in this case is Congress's intent. And in 1964, Congress considered this crime so serious that it made it punishable by death and it exempted it from any limitation on prosecution. Nothing that's happened after 1964 has changed the way Congress has viewed this offense at that time. The Jackson decision, the only thing that changed after the Jackson decision is that the death penalty clause for federal kidnapping became unenforceable. As a result, anything that was directly tied to the possibility that a defendant could be put to death became inapplicable. That does not include statute of limitations. Every other court of appeals that has addressed this issue has concluded that a crime that is capital at the time it is committed continues to be treated as capital for limitations purposes, even if the death penalty cannot be imposed.
That's, do you have a case, though, that was decided after the 72 amendment?
All of the statute of limitations, almost, yes, all of the statute of limitations cases.
Considered that Congress had repealed the statute?
Dealing with the repeal of the 1972 amendment? Well, our position is that after 1972, the new five-year limitation period would have applied, but because Congress repealed only the death penalty, it did not expressly change the statute of limitations. That amendment applied only going forward. We don't have, with respect, well, actually, we have a case that's very similar. The panel has asked us what effect the 1994 Act has had on the limitations period for this case, and our position is similar to the defense, but for a different reason. We believe the 1994 Act had no effect on the limitations period applicable to this case because, like the 1972 amendment, it applied prospectively only. And there is a case which we have provided to the court, to the courtroom deputy, and it's called United States v. Owens. And in that case, the court held that the 1994 death penalty amendments do not retroactively alter the applicable statute of limitations from the five-year to the no limitations for an offense that was not punishable by death at the time it was committed, because there was no evidence that Congress intended to change the statute of limitations for offenses committed before 1994. And the court explained that the enactment of what is nothing more than a sentencing statute without any reference to the statute of limitations is a strong indicator that Congress intended to remove the limitations period only as to crimes committed after the effective date of the 1994 Act. That directly supports our position that the 1972 amendment repealing the death penalty cannot apply retroactively for statute of limitations purposes.
All right, let me ask you this. I mean, you agree that in 1972, for crimes committed after 1972, there's a five-year limitation.
Absolutely. So, between 1972 and 1994.
All right, so take this case. In 1972, 5 years later, 1977, why wasn't this claim prescribed in 1977?
Because the 1972 amendment did not expressly change the statute of limitations. Therefore, there is no retroactive application of the statute of limitations to this case. What's important is how Congress viewed this offense in 1964. And in 1964, it made it punishable by death. And
I understand all that, but what's your best case for the fact that that amendment of the statute does not affect the statute of limitations?
Our best case is the statute itself. You have to look at the language of the
I'm
statute.
I'm asking for your best case. Do you
well,
have
a
case?
United States v. Owens, which rejects the reasoning, actually, in Provenzano, which is cited by the defense. This explains that this decision is consistent with those cases upholding the application of 3281, where a death penalty provision has been repealed or declared unconstitutional. It cites favorably Manning and Kuhn, which are cited in our brief, but C, rejecting the holding of Provenzano. And it goes on to explain that absent a clear congressional intent to change the statute of limitations, courts apply the statute that was in effect at the time of the offense, even if the potential penalty is subsequently changed. We're simply asking that the court apply the law in effect in 1964. That is the 1964 version of the kidnapping statute and the applicable statute of limitations that was in effect at that time. That's exactly what we always do, absent express intent from Congress to retroactively change the crime retroactively.
Do you have anything other than that District of Massachusetts case?
Well, we have the cases dealing with statutory interpretation, and of course the savings clause, including this court's decision in the Blue Sea Line case. That's a savings clause case that says that the statute in effect at the time of the offense is saved if Congress later repeals it, if Congress changes the penalty. And again, you have to look at Congress's intent. Is Congress intending to make a substantive change or a procedural change? In this case, Congress, both in 1972 and in 1994, was intending to make a substantive change. A repeal of the penalty or an amendment to the penalty for kidnapping is clearly substantive that applies prospectively only. And Congress understood that in doing that, that it was also changing prospectively only the applicable statute of limitations. With respect
Manning,
to Stogner,
Manning,
I'm sorry.
You have Manning in that line of cases.
Absolutely.
But they only deal with the post-Furman situation, not the post-congressional amendment situation.
Kuhn dealt with post-Jackson. It was a bank robbery case, but if you recall correctly, bank robbery, the death penalty clause of bank robbery was struck down on the same grounds that the death penalty clause in kidnapping was struck down in a companion case after Jackson called United States v. Pope. It was just a one-sentence decision by the Supreme Court incorporating by reference its holding in Jackson. And so the bank robbery cases also fall within the post-Jackson line of cases. And the Eighth Circuit, the only difference between Kuhn and this case is that the defendant in Kuhn was prosecuted, both committed the crime and was prosecuted before Jackson, but then tried to argue on appeal that Jackson rendered it non-capital for limitations purposes. The court disagreed. The Eighth Circuit has then gone on in two or three subsequent cases to extend that holding to offenses committed when the death penalty has been declared unconstitutional, holding that 3281 still applies. And I'd just like to remind the court, of course the court knows this, even today, if the crime had been committed today with the available death penalty, even when the government does not seek the death penalty, but it's available, it's still subject to no limitation on prosecution.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah, we're not asking the court to do anything that it wasn't doing before Jackson and that it can't do today. Certain protections apply when the death penalty is off the table, or rather apply when the death penalty is on the table and don't apply when they're off. Same with statute of limitations. The same 3281 continues to govern these crimes, whether or not the death penalty is available because it would be constitutional or because the government has decided to seek it or waive it.
What do you do with the statement in Hoyt and Kaiser, both from this court, that the federal kidnapping statute is, quote, non-capital for all purposes?
I think it's clear that this court was dealing with narrow issues in those cases. The court was clearly talking about the procedural protections that apply to a capital case when a defendant is in fact facing the death penalty.
But when it says non-capital for all purposes, that's a pretty global statement, isn't it?
Well, the district court held that to the extent that can be read more broadly than the holdings in those cases, that it's probably dicta. And I would like to point out that in Kaiser, this court explicitly recognized a connection between those procedural protections and the death penalty. It said, quote, in view of our decisions that the capital punishment provision of 18 U.S.C. 1111 is unconstitutional and void, the strict procedural guarantees of 3432, that's the jury and witness rule, was not properly applicable to this trial. It was clearly recognizing that it's only talking about procedural protections that are explicitly or implicitly tied to the death penalty. And that's consistent with the circuit's law if the death penalty is available and the government has explicitly waived it, is not seeking it, this court has held that defendants are not entitled to those protections. That's no different. But I'd also like to point out that Kaiser and Hoyt were decided in the early to mid-70s. Every court of appeals that has addressed the statute of limitations issue has concluded otherwise, and that's as recently as 2004, and that, by the way, is after Stogner. I'm not quite sure what relevance Stogner has here, but to the extent the panel is concerned about that, this is the Fourth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, even the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces all agree that statutes of limitations are tied to the severity of the serious nature of the offense and not to the severity of the penalty. So those continue to apply, and that issue was not ever directly presented within the context of the litigation of Hoyt and Kaiser.
How would Congress be able to change the statute of limitations on kidnapping?
It would have to.
If you take the position that the fact that they downgraded it from capital to non-capital didn't do it, how would they do it?
Expressly, they would have to enact a separate statute of limitations, which Congress knows how to do. Congress has done that with a number of other criminal laws and enacted a special
such
statute.
As what?
For example, certain offenses, recently in fact, certain offenses against children are subject to a different statute of limitations under 3283. terrorism, for example, certain acts of terrorism, they've extended the statute of limitations for that in 3286. Congress could do this, can lengthen or shorten the statute of limitations explicitly, and it knows how to do that.
Well, but in to change the statute of limitation, it'd have to change the generic term capital offense, wouldn't it? It'd have to enumerate what they all were.
It could have enacted a separate statute of limitations in the among the other amendments that it was making to the kidnapping statute in kidnapping, or it could have created a whole new statute of limitations applicable just to certain offenses such as kidnapping or bank robbery. But Congress knows how to do this, and the rule is unless there's express intent.
What is the reason for Congress reinstating the capital penalty in 94?
The reason, I assume, is deterrence of these, to deter serious crimes, Your Honor.
We can't infer anything about their intent?
In terms of statute of limitations? Or in terms of the death penalty?
I mean, you're inferring that any time they change the penalty, then the Congress has something in mind about the statute of limitations.
No, I'm not. I'm saying both in 1972 and 1994, Congress was concerned only with the death penalty, with either increasing or decreasing the penalty for certain crimes.
So we assume Congress knows the effect of its legislation.
Absolutely. And Congress also knows that when it makes substantive changes to a statute, that those changes can apply prospectively only. Thus, as the Court said in Owens, which is the case I cited earlier, Congress understood that the new limitations period, absent some sort of expression to the contrary, would apply prospectively only.
And what is the difference between the 94 amendment and the 72 amendment that determines whether or not the change in the statute of limitation is to be prospective only or to cover cases then pending?
Our position is that there is no difference. Both in 1972 and in 1994, Congress made amendments to the death penalty, to the penalty provision of the kidnapping statute, and in 1994 to many other statutes. In both instances, those substantive changes to the penalty applied prospectively only. It had no effect retroactively on the case. We're simply asking that the Court apply the law in effect at the time in 1964.
Well, but why didn't 72 change 64 on the same reasoning that you're arguing about?
It's the same. We're saying that 1994 didn't apply retroactively either. Perhaps I wasn't clear. Our position is that neither 1972 nor the 1994 amendment retroactively change the statute of limitations.
On any crime that had been previously committed, is that what you're saying?
Correct.
So there would be some kidnappings that were still unlimited as far as statute of limitations, but after 72, new kidnappings would only be 5 years.
Correct.
And then in 94, they changed it back. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes.
For what reason?
The reason was to restore the death penalty. I don't think Congress was concerned about the statute of limitations. There's no evidence in the legislative history of either the 94 Act or the 72 Act that Congress was concerned about or thinking about statute of limitations. That was sort of like an indirect effect it had on the way those would be prosecuted.
But as Judge Davis mentioned, don't we assume that Congress knows what is the consequence of the changes it's making?
Exactly, and Congress understands that those changes apply prospectively only.
And why do they understand that when there's a general rule that procedural changes such as prescription apply retroactively?
Procedural changes can apply retroactively, but again, neither the 1972 amendment nor the 1994 amendment rendered a purely procedural change.
Well, it had a procedural effect when it changed the statute of limitations.
That's not enough. You need evidence of Congress's intent. This Court addressed this exact same issue in the Blue Sea Line case, which is cited in our brief. It said when you're looking to see whether or not a particular change applies retroactively or not, you have to look at Congress's intent, and you have to decide whether or not Congress intended to render a substantive change or a procedural change. And there's no evidence, absolutely zero evidence, in either 1972 or 1994 that Congress was concerned with rendering some sort of procedural change. These are substantive changes. These are changes to the way offenders of the kidnapping statute are punished. Penalties are
in the Blue Sea Line, was there a substantive change that had a procedural consequence?
Well, this Court looked, there was, and this Court, the question in that, the issue in that case was whether or not Congress intended to change the procedure by which a particular penalty was, a particular statute was enforced, or actually change the substance of the penalty, because the penalty actually remained the same. And in both instances, this court took a look at the legislative history and decided that Congress was concerned about the way that the particular statute was being administered. It kept the penalty the same, but it made it, it changed it from a criminal sanction to a civil penalty, and it was because it was easier to enforce if it was civil rather than having to go through all the procedures to get a case referred from an agency to the Department of Justice for a criminal prosecution.
I mean, you agree that generally prescription is considered procedural. Just as a general legal proposition.
Prescription is considered procedural. But that's not what happened in this case, Your Honor. I'm not sure I understand the question, actually.
Well, statute of limitations or prescription is considered procedural.
Yes, and again, there's no evidence. If you look at the legislative history of the 1972 Act, this legislation originally came about because Congress was interested in restoring the death penalty following Jackson. It wanted to bring the death penalty in compliance with the Supreme Court's decision in Jackson.
I mean, the only thing I'm asking you is if you've got a procedural change being argued, why is there such a strong presumption against retroactive effect?
Because the rule is that it has to be expressly changed. There's no rule that everything that is indirectly impacted by a substantive change is a procedural change that applies retroactively.
Give us the case that stands for the proposition that it has to be expressly stated?
For beginners, United States v. Owens, which is the case I provided to the court before argument.
When was that case decided?
1997, Your Honor.
District of Massachusetts. Do you have anything else?
We have all of the Supreme Court cases and the Circuit Court cases cited in our brief that talk about statutory interpretation and that talk about, I would cite the Blue Sea Line case first because that's a circuit decision.
Clearly, if Congress tells us one way or the other what it wants to do, we're bound to go with that. I understand that. Now, it seems to me in this case, Congress did not say expressly what it wanted to do regarding the elimination of the death penalty in 72 on the statute of limitations. Is that correct?
Correct. And absent some sort of congressional expression, we cannot impute to evidence in the legislative history, we cannot assume that Congress intended to alter the statute of limitations.
I know that's the government's position, but you don't give us a case that says that.
Well, I would cite all the cases in our brief that deal with statutory interpretation. In fact, let me give you one additional case because I found this in response to the question from the panel on the 94 Act. And this looked at whether or not the 94 Death Penalty Act could be applied retroactively for purposes of imposing the death penalty. Ex post facto aside, it talked about retroactive intent and whether or not the death penalty amendments were procedural or substantive in nature in restoring the death penalty. And the court held that it was not, that you need some sort of expression from Congress that intended to change something retroactively. That's United States v. Saffarini, 247 F sub 2nd, 191, District of Columbia, 2003.
You know, I know that, but I can find you a lot of cases that say when you have a procedural matter that you're talking about, there is no presumption against retroactive application of a procedural change.
A procedural change. Again, Congress did not explicitly render a procedural change.
That's the case that I'm missing, except for that Massachusetts case.
Yeah.
It says that when Congress passes a substantive amendment that has ancillary procedural effect,
mm-hmm.
that you don't give that procedural change retroactive application.
Again, I would cite the Blue Sea Line case from the circuit. It's binding circuit precedent. I've been instructed to wrap up as my yellow light is on.
I wanted to ask you one thing about that expert's testimony, Dr. Hain.
Yes, sir.
What did he contribute to the trial? Was it essential for the government to show that the victims died of drowning?
It was part of our theory. There was many other witnesses that supported the theory that they were drowned. Of course, Charles Edwards testified that the defendant drove them.
Is that essential to your case that you show that he died by drowning?
It was essential to show that they were still alive while they were being transported across state lines.
And what did he base his opinion on that they died of drowning?
Well, as he stated in his expert report, which, by the way, was prepared more than a week before trial, it's dated May 23rd, and it's contained in the defendant's record excerpts under tab 9.
He testified, though, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he testified based...
Testimony. Don't give me his report.
Based on his report. He testified based on his report, and as he said in his report and in court...
Give me something from the record.
He said that he relied on the 1964 autopsy and anthropological reports, photographs and video footage of the victim's remains, official FBI reports regarding the location and condition of the remains, and from that he was able to conclude that the manner of death was homicide, just as the defense expert testified, and he found no significant antemortem injury to the bone tissue, and from that he was able to rule out several other causes of death, such as death by beating, stabbing, shotgun wound, etc.
He could look at the soft tissue and tell that they drowned?
There was no soft tissue available. He was able to rule out, based on no injury to the bone, all these other causes of death. His opinion, by the way, was that freshwater drowning was only the probable cause of death, not conclusive or definitive.
Was an autopsy done by anybody in Mississippi at the time of the occasion of these deaths?
Yes, Your Honor, and those autopsy reports are in the record.
What do they say about cause of death?
I believe at that time it was not required to give a cause of death. As Dr. Hain testified, that there was no requirement in Mississippi at that time to render an opinion, so I think they were silent on the issue.
Okay.
There's no further questions. Government respectfully asks this court to affirm. Thank you.
All right. Back to you, Ms. Nestor.
May it please the court, if I could just pick up exactly where she finished. Dr. Hain's testimony was essential to prove federal jurisdiction. If the defendants had died prior to crossing state lines, there was no federal case. Dr. Hain based his entire testimony on Charles Edwards' explanation of what occurred and basically said he had nothing to prove it to the contrary. There was an autopsy done at the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian, the premier expert in the country, reached a conclusion that there was no way to determine if drowning had occurred in this case. And Dr. Hain added nothing to that except he sat in the courtroom and listened to Edwards. And our argument was that was wholly improper bolstering and not scientific evidence at all. So I would like to have addressed that. Also, when Your Honor asked the government to give their best case relying on the proposition for retroactivity, they talked about the Manning and Kuhn case. Your Honors, Kuhn specifically said we are accepting, there is no, the post-Jackson prosecution problem is not before us, and we are not deciding it. So they specifically carved out this entire case as part of their reasoning. And I've already explained to the court that the Manning cases and all the cases that flow from Manning all go back to Watson, and the key for Watson was Congress gave us their intent in 1201, but in these Furman cases, this penumbra of Furman cases, we have no evidence that they want us to start treating it differently because they haven't removed the capital language, and that's what we have to go on. And I think it's important to note, in 72, when Furman came down, if Congress had wanted to, they could have started slashing and burning the death penalty language and statute after statute. None of the Furman penumbra cases were amended by Congress.
What's your argument that the 72 amendment was a substantive change? I don't think there's any doubt that changing the penalty from capital to non-capital is substantive. And why shouldn't we give that substantive amendment prospective application only?
I think Your Honor was exactly right that the law always dictates that procedural is retroactive. I would like to give you an analogy that came out of the Supreme Court that I think is dead on. The Daubert case that the government argued. It's a case where a man killed his children. He killed his children at the time that the death penalty language was unconstitutional under Furman. Then Florida went back and fixed their statute, but he'd already been indicted, and by the time he got to trial, they had fixed the Furman problems in Florida. So at trial, they'd used the death penalty procedures, aggravating, mitigating, all the things they fixed after Furman. He went to court and said, wait a minute, this was a substantive change. This affected how they applied the death penalty. This shouldn't apply to me. It should be ex post facto. In Daubert, the Supreme Court said, nope,
It was procedural, and it was ameliorative. It gave you more rights than you had before, and we are going to apply it retroactively to you. And the same thing is occurring with this statute of limitations argument. It's ameliorative. It got less, not more, and it dealt with procedural issues. And I found no authority to suggest anything different.
What about the Blue Seal case counsel talked about?
Well, in the Blue Seal case, Your Honor, I think they were looking at it in terms of the civil aspect of it, is my recollection of the Blue Seal case. It didn't deal with the issues that are here before this court. It dealt with the general concept of procedural retroactivity. But the point I think at the bottom line is you've got the government is trying to cram kidnapping back into the Furman scenario, and it's not there. And it's not there because Jackson pulled it out and because Congress pulled it out. And the point being that at the point when we're all very clear it's time to start prosecuting, the government had every bit of evidence that they had available to them in 1972 where they could have picked Mr. Seal up and tried him. The government is on notice. The clock is ticking. This is not a capital offense. The government made the decision not to pick him up, not to prosecute him, and let that time run not only 5 years, but 20-some years before they decided to bring him back. And now they're asking you to forgive their decision to ignore what the Supreme Court said, what the Congress said, and take the risk themselves that somehow this would jump back in time to an unconstitutional law that not one person disagrees it's an unconstitutional law. Not the Supreme Court, not the Congress, not the government. Everybody agrees Jackson is exactly right, and the way that statute was drafted forced a defendant to pick between going to trial and risking the death penalty or pleading guilty and not risking the death penalty, which was unconstitutional on its face. And they're asking you to go back under that statute and apply it now, and we think that's improper.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We have your case.